Welcome to the ABR podcast, where some of Australian Book Review's contributors read their articles or discuss them with ABR staff. My name's Georgina Arnott and I'm the assistant editor at ABR. If you enjoy these podcasts, think about subscribing to the magazine. Those 25 and under can do so for as little as $25 for the online version or $60 for print plus online.
My name is Christopher Menz, and I lead the ABR Cultural Tours, which we present in association with Academy Travel. After our hugely successful tour to Vienna last year, we will lead a 13-day residential tour of Vienna this year. This will take in the spectacular collections of the Habsburgs, the musical heritage of Haydn, Mozart and Beethoven, and the striking modernist architecture of the city. Vienna, where we will be based throughout the tour in October, is an ideal city for an extended stay, and the programme has been designed to make the most of its many attractions. Several musical performances will feature in the programme, and full details are available on the Academy Travel website.
In this week's ABR podcast, Sasha Morell reviews Matthew Lamb's biography, Frank Morehouse, Strange Paths. Morell considers the allure of a writer who left scraps and clues for his future biographer from the age of 17. Matthew Lamb might be the ideal reader for this voluminous archive, explains Morell, and seems to match Morehouse's capacity for telling the truth bit by bit, wink by nudge. Sasha Morell is a regular ABR contributor and a lecturer in literary studies at Monash University, who has published widely on Australian and American literatures. Here she is with When I Am Famous, a masterpiece of biographical synthesis, published in the April issue of ABR.
Frank Morehouse, Strange Paths, has no introduction. But Matthew Lamb describes it in his author's note as the first in a projected two-volume cultural biography of Frank Morehouse, covering the long apprenticeship over the years 1938 to 74, during which Morehouse broke into the literary establishment on his own terms. Lamb does not explain his use of the term cultural biography within the book, but the term is apt to describe how biography intersects with social history as the book tracks Morehouse's negotiation of shifting social conventions and historical moments, as Lamb puts it in an article on the Penguin website titled When the Facts Conflict with the Legend, How Does a Biographer Balance Storytelling with the Truth? Lamb's Frank Morehouse is a masterpiece of synthesis. Lamb has amassed insights from a remarkable range of sources, from private correspondence and notebooks through to unpublished or uncollected fiction and essays. Fascinating Juvenilia testifies to Morehouse's extreme precocity as a satirist and social observer, and the early onset of a lifelong habit of intensive self-scrutiny, which did not always translate into self-awareness. The archive is enlivened with oral history, gleanings from myriad conversations and interviews with not only Morehouse, but numerous intimate acquaintances of the author, including some anonymous and highly sensitive material. Having, to quote, immersed himself in Morehouse's archived life and its cultural contexts, Lamb stays submerged throughout Frank Morehouse, the biography, as the discreet yet abiding presence holding together the whole. Rarely does this biographer editorialize or draw inferences from the material, implicitly trusting in readers to make the connections. He seems to be writing neither for a broad audience, nor for insiders, nor for himself, but as if driven by a sense of duty to do justice to his subject for an abstract posterity. His own bare minimum bio on the book's dust jacket is an index of this self-effacing style. A mere four lines convey that Lamb is former editor of the Review of Australian Fiction and Island magazines, and that he has two PhDs in literature and philosophy. And I won't lie, the book often reads as though it were written by someone whose passion for research could hardly be exhausted by one PhD alone. Lam is addicted to the archive. The book does not begin with any big picture claims about Morehouse's cultural significance or by making a case for his continued relevance. Instead, following an epigraph drawn from an undated index card, Lam opens the first chapter rather bravely with reference to a handwritten emendation Morehouse made to his typescript for a 1980s talk before the Nowra Historical Society. The second paragraph introduces another set of typescript notes, no date given, from the Frank Morehouse papers at the University of Queensland. The handwritten emendation of the first paragraph concerns the need for, quote, the right words to accurately record one's impressions. Morehouse aficionados will perceive resonances with the preoccupations of more than one Morehouse protagonist and with persistent themes in Morehouse's non-fiction. But Lam provides no orientation for less seasoned readers. On the second page, without further ado, Lam tells readers that to adequately understand Morehouse, it is first necessary to examine the archival ghosts that Morehouse carried within himself, and proceeds to what he calls an impressionistic prehistory, entwining fragmented, seemingly unrelated historical stories. Don't get used to even this degree of signposting. Unless you already know a lot about Morehouse, you won't know why Lam is introducing this or that theme or motif at a given point. For instance, if readers have enjoyed Morehouse's fiction, but are unacquainted with Morehouse's twin obsessions with literary censorship and copyright, they may be puzzled as to why Lam's prehistory includes information on these matters as they evolved in Australia over the 19th and early 20th centuries. A subsection on Marcus Clarke's For the Term of His Natural Life is one of several that makes no reference at all to Morehouse's forebears, ending on the coy observation that Clarke's talent reached beyond the capacity of his own society to justly reward that talent. Did Morehouse admire Clarke? If you don't already know, Lam won't update you. This whole chapter is full of winks and nudges, or in contemporary parlance, Easter eggs, for the seasoned Morehouse reader, of whom I fear there may be fewer these days than Lam would like to imagine. All this is another way of saying that Lam does not tarry with the so what question. Frank Morehouse's Strange Paths relies not only on assumed knowledge, but also on assumed interest. This latter assumption is probably fair in a literary biography, and some will welcome the snub to the genre's storytelling conventions. In any case, the narrative gathers momentum as Lam follows Morehouse's development through all the milestones we expect in a literary biography: how the author came to write his first story, his early experiences of publication and editing school magazines, his discovery of authors who became literary influences, rejection letters, and so on, and Morehouse's bloody-minded quest to be published in Mianjin, despite countless snubs, affords something of a comic subplot. There is his entry into journalism, compulsory military service, his evolving politics, including his famous association with the radical libertarian movement known as the Sydney Push, which Lam presents as being more ambivalent than legend would have it. Meanwhile, there are countless love affairs, I lost count anyway, including several on-again, off-again attachments. Perhaps the most important love affair of Morehouse's life was his relationship with alcohol, which Morehouse was already writing about as early as 1955, a full half century before his Martini, a Memoir, was published. In his article on the Penguin website, Lam relates that he had never really considered how biographies were written before taking on this project, and had to abandon his initial, embarrassingly naive, quote, plan of establishing a chronological outline, then fleshing it out from the archive, for he found much that contradicted both the legend and his timeline. What Lam did not abandon was the chronological approach itself, which is perhaps somewhat surprising, given Morehouse's championship of the discontinuous narrative as a literary form. Frank Moorhouse is actually more strictly chronological than most literary biographies, which tend to point back and forward in time to foreshadow how later developments in an author's life and career relate to earlier ones, creating suggestive juxtapositions through prolepsis. Not Lamb. Apart from the prehistory, the book's coda is Lamb's only extended excursion in the deliberate arrangement of materials independent of chronology, hopping more freely between texts and time periods. It is here that we find out, in the most understated way, the source of Lamb's subtitle, Strange Paths. And we get Moorhouse reflecting on his prehistory in ways that sound very much like what Lamb attempts in early chapters. A quote from Moorhouse, "Piece together my customs traditions, track back before parents." Moorhouse himself was no stranger to abandoning careful plans. In the book, we see him aspiring to an intentional life, engaged in continual self-scrutiny of his approach to writing, personal relationships, and just about everything else. But Lamb reveals a person whose in-principle commitment to radical honesty was undercut by shame, secrecy, and self-deception, and whose obsession with order was offset by hedonism. Besides the excessive drinking, Lamb mentions unpaid accounts from David Jones's gourmet food court. Moorhouse's lifelong fascination with etiquette and good form is evident in his earliest writings, such as his formal acceptance letter, written when he was just 11, thanking his father for the opportunity of coming to the staff dinner of Frank Sr.'s company. Characters in stories Moorhouse wrote at 16 or 17 cultivate personal codes of conduct, while Moorhouse's notes for those stories include conscious reflections on his purposes in writing them. The will to intentionality is nowhere more clearly documented than when Lamb quotes from two starts Moorhouse made on keeping a private journal. "Today I have decided to begin my journal. I am aged 17 and 5 months. I think the journal will record what I call seeings, which will provide material for future stories. Today I have decided to write a journal. I am aged 18 years and 5 months. I think the journal will consist of what I call significant incidents, which will provide material for future literary work." Such regulated, intentional exercise of the creative faculties is redolent of Moorhouse's T. George McDowell from The Electrical Experience, and reminiscent of F. Scott Fitzgerald's Jay Gatsby with his gauche boyhood notes for self-improvement. But far more revealing is that the gesture had to be repeated, showing a failure to stick to the plan. It is surely rare for a literary biographer to find an author providing such an extensive running commentary on his own Bildung as Lamb found in Moorhouse, whose teenaged writings include essays with titles like The World and Me and Rambling in the Mind of an Adolescent, Part 2. Extrapolating general observations about adolescence from himself as case study. That Moorhouse was hardly what is now termed neurotypical is suggested through the author's own words in the title of Lamb's fourth chapter, "I Feel Like Some Other Species Looking at Humans." But it's not until page 437 that Lamb mentions a review of The Electrical Experience, calling T. George McDowell a South Coast Martian, so that Lamb's readers might connect the fact and fiction. Lamb is too sensitive to the thorough transfiguration of lived experience through imaginative writing, on which he can quote Moorhouse himself to produce naive biographical readings of Moorhouse's fiction. Like his heroine Edith Campbell Berry, with her capitalized ways, Moorhouse meditated extensively on social and sexual etiquette in both private and published writings. He was famously in favor of sexual freedom and frankness, in principle, at least. Lamb, in turn, would never insult readers by suggesting they would be so closed-minded as not to want to hear the details of Moorhouse's sexual experience, right down to the stickiness of his first wet dream. Yet there's something curiously decorous and contained in the way that both Moorhouse and Lamb write about sexual experiences whether positive or negative, and Lamb's respectfully straightforward treatment of such matters as erectile dysfunction, internalized homophobia, and sexual assault is admirable. I was surprised by the very young age from which Morehouse's preoccupation with and conduct of sex and relationships was informed by book learning, from Dorsey and Kinsey to, later on, Sartre and Beauvoir, even Durkheim. There is also a whiff of the boardroom. In Chapter 7, Lamb cites a typescript in which Morehouse outlines a four-stage plan for salvaging his relationship with then-girlfriend Sandra Grimes. Certain parts of the central relationship must be preserved and protected, Morehouse informed Grimes, adding, "It is perhaps a case of symbols and rituals. Symbols and rituals which mark the faith and strength of the relationship." It's as if Morehouse is talking about a participant in a clinical study rather than himself. One of his so-called discussion papers for Sandra parenthetically promises an appendix on honesty to come. For me, the heart of Lamb's book came in this seventh chapter, where the deep contradictions of Morehouse's outlook on life and relationships are most exposed, yet also properly historicized as an index of Morehouse grappling with his sexuality and gender identity in a repressive culture he himself helped to change. Nonetheless, it's hard not to feel frustrated for Wendy Holloway, who was married to Morehouse from 1959 to 1963, when Lamb describes Morehouse, quote, espousing to her what he called his frankness and sincerity theory, only to commence a clandestine affair with John Burroughs, one of many things he withheld from Wendy. Morehouse was such an eclectic, complex and contradictory person that Lamb's book provides an intense, even gripping reading experience by the sheer depth of access it affords. There is, moreover, far more art to Frank Morehouse than might be assumed at first glance. Far from lamenting a lack of selectivity, one suspects that what we're given is a tiny fraction of what was available to Lamb. Every page holds intrigue. I was unaware of the extent of Morehouse's acquaintance with Canadian media theorist Marshall McLuhan, for instance, or the manner of Morehouse's falling out with Michael Wilding. If I longed for a little more editorializing, it was only because Lamb is so insightful. In the stray moments when he allows himself to gloss an incident or passage, his observations are pithy and perceptive, as when he comments on Morehouse's tendency to hide behind a rational framework, speaking in generalities, as a covert confessional mode, or when he deftly summarizes the complex tone of filming the hatted Australian from The Electrical Experience. Frank Morehouse is not a story of material struggle. Morehouse experienced scarcity and precarity at times, but this was usually because he relinquished steady employment to concentrate his energies on becoming a professional writer. The idea of the writer as worker was one of Morehouse's own research interests. Much of the melancholy I felt while reading this book was for the current generation of aspiring young writers and journalists, for whom the paths Morehouse was able to carve out may look not only strange, but downright otherworldly. A school leaver who was never a top student, immediately gaining employment as a copy boy, then working his way up as a cadet journalist through to editing a regional newspaper, remember those, by the age of 21 without any professional qualifications? Today, what equivalent paths would be open to one with Morehouse's talent and energy? And let's not get started on the condition of Australian literary magazines, which Lamb himself fought valiantly to palliate during his editorship at Island. It seems apt that this volume culminates in the publication of The Electrical Experience, itself a cultural biography of sorts, and by far Morehouse's best work in my view. I hope that the biography Frank Morehouse's Strange Paths will bring renewed attention to Morehouse's short fiction and discontinuous narratives, which the Edith trilogy has somewhat eclipsed. I was struck by the following lines that Morehouse penned in 1957, lineated as if they were verse, as some of Morehouse's more emotional private writings seem to be. Here I sit at my old school desk, where I wrote many to-be-world-shattering short stories, which lie in the folders, marked 1954, 1955, carefully preserved to exist. Those who want my old work when I am famous. Lamb is one of those, of course, the ideal future reader Morehouse could only have dreamed of at the time. We read these lines with the dramatic irony of knowing of the literary fame and fortune yet to come, but also with knowledge of the falling off in Morehouse's literary prominence in recent years. I fear I am one of very few people born after 1980 to have a research interest in Frank Morehouse. I doubt many of my undergraduates, any, have even heard of him. At the very least, Lamb's Frank Morehouse will be of great interest to a small audience, some of whom, like me, will eagerly await the second volume, tantalized by the words of Morehouse, quoted by Lamb, that no one tells the truth all at once. You get it bit by bit.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Book Review podcast. Join us again next week. If you enjoyed this episode, why not consider subscribing to ABR? Subscriptions start from just $10 a month for full digital access. Visit our website for more information. We'd like to thank Stacey Chan, who edits the podcast, as well as our contributors who take the time to read their articles and creative writing. And if you enjoy listening to the ABR podcast, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes.